Here we go. March 1st. Wow. 2009. Lecture discussion number 82 on Genesis 1 through 19. And today marks the beginning of the end of the two birds of Genesis 15. And you notice I've erased the board. So that means as soon as I am done with this group of lectures, Genesis 15 is over. And with perseverance and endurance, it's my hope that the answer to why the two birds of Genesis 15 were not divided will be complete within 3 weeks. Now, let me say this. I think it is one of the most important discussions you can have in all of Scripture. I hope that's clear to you today. Admittedly, it's my position, or at least the one I agree most with, that I'm going to give you, and some, as usual, will disagree with the conclusion I'll present over the next coming weeks, but I think that the other views are sufficiently dispatched by just careful analysis. I think that the other views do not hold where we're going to end up. I hope we will agree with that. I think we shall see that. And the reason I say that, and I recognize I'm going kind of slow a little bit today, this is a serious place for me. I'll get into that a little bit more as we go along. And I cannot tell you, I cannot explain to you why it is so serious until we get into it. But I think the other views, as I said, are going to fall to the wayside because of the evidence of Moses and Elijah. Because of Revelation 11. Revelation 11 is the ministry and the mystery of the two witnesses. And what they're able to do, what their signs mean. They bring fire from their mouths that devour their enemies. No rain falls during their ministry. They turn water into blood. They strike the earth with all plagues. What they're able to do, not just from a sign standpoint, but what they're able to do physically is extraordinary, and it's all of great import. But their great sign is their death and resurrection. The fact that their death and resurrection is the conclusion of their ministry. That's, as I said, their great sign. And that's announced why the come up here of 11:12, Revelation 11:12. God shouts out, screams out, come up here. And doing so, hopefully, makes you relate to the other come up heres in Scripture. One of them is obvious, and that's Revelation 4:1. So immediately when you read 11:12 of Revelation and 4:1 of Revelation, these two come up heres, you know they tie together. But I will tell you that there's another come up here, another shout. And that's 1 Thessalonians 4:15 through 18. And that in itself usually is enough. Just those three come up heres is enough to explain the two birds. Why they're not divided. 1 Thessalonians 4, Revelation 4, Revelation 11. Now, when you add in Leviticus 14, the great ritual for the cleansing of the heel, the alive leper, the fact that I have an alive leper, I have a cleansed leper, when you add in Leviticus 14, and then, of course, Luke 4:27, where only Christ heals lepers, the case is pretty much made why the two birds aren't divided. It's solved. And therefore, now you know what the two undivided birds testify of, what they teach, why they're so important. You're done. Never forget, however, foremost, that they are symbols of Christ. They testify of Him. They teach of Christ. They portray Christ. Everything in the Old Testament does, so you always must have the Christology, and then you can continue to search. The Christology is why Mary and Joseph bring a sacrifice of two birds. When you understand why the two birds are not undivided, why they're not separated, why they're not cut in two in Genesis 15, then you will understand why Mary and Joseph bring two birds. Because it has everything to do with the virgin birth. See, it's only logical that they would bring two birds. Because this is God Himself in the flesh. This is the hypostatic union. This is God adding humanity. Did Mary and Joseph really understand that? I don't know that they did. They barely, maybe. Nonetheless, they brought two birds. Maybe God, of course, conditioned that. It is usually the poor that bring birds. Ultimately, they weren't very poor for long, were they? They had a whole bunch of gold, some embalming fluid, and some incense. But for at the beginning here, they brought a sacrifice of two birds, and I would expect that they would have to, understanding what the two birds mean. Anyway, so far, it's likely that I have said anything that makes sense to you so far this morning. And to that I respond, what else is new? And then wait till you find out what else is coming. Maybe the greatest drool fest of my career. And there's no maybe about it. As I've written it, I can't even begin to explain it. But it's perhaps the most important that I have ever attempted. And I think that I'll look back at it in the next few weeks. All right, I'm sorry, I'll look back at these next few weeks that are coming someday, and I'll reflect on it. You see, it's my intention, within the bounds of answering the undivided bird's question, to prove the existence of your soul and your spirit, to remove all doubt from you that your soul and your spirit exist. Which means what? If you are saved, you are immortal. Which means that you shall not fear death. You will inherit everlasting life. I will prove it to you. That is the lesson of the two birds. To prove the existence of your soul spirit. If I'm successful, the implications of such a proof are beyond comprehension. That should be expected. You should expect it to be beyond comprehension. But it isn't. God made it. The implications are, but the understanding of it isn't. He explains it to Abraham in Genesis 15. If you understand it, he's explaining it to you. Every child you have, every teenager you've ever had or going to have, I see one sitting in here, sooner or later will lay in bed and say, how do I know I exist? What is my purpose? What am I doing? How did I get here? How is it that I think? What is consciousness? Everyone does it. I'm going to prove to you with the two birds that God has given you a soul spirit. It's why I saved the two undivided birds for last. It is the fitting end to the Genesis 1 through 19 series. I look at it sometimes as the culmination of all the teaching I have ever done. And I certainly am doing that now. And some of you may consider after today to rush out and invite your friends and family. What a novel concept that would be, huh? Or why start now might be my next thought. You'd be wise to do so. For an understanding, a firm grasp of the existence of your soul, of the existence of your spirit, what your soul and spirit is, how it works, how you function, how you're designed, is very, very valuable wisdom. It will change how you think. I hope. And it is, as I said, of great consequences. Once one knows, notice I don't say feels. I don't think, I don't say believes. I don't say thinks. Once you know of, and that's the great question of Genesis 15:8, isn't it? How can I know? He doesn't ask him, how can I have faith in? How can I believe? How can I think? How can I know? You can know. Once one knows of his soul or his, her soul, spirit's reality of its being, there remains no more defense at your trial. And you're going to have a trial. So am I. I remove your defense. I am ruining your life right now. If you stay. So when you go to invite somebody, keep in mind that this is very solemn, solemn stuff. The implications are eternal. So yes, bring somebody the next few Sundays. It'll be a time of serious consequential thought. And again, the warning, be prepared for Matthew 7:6. Don't cast your pearls before the swine. Be prepared for that. Because pearls mean children in that verse. Don't put your children in front of animals. They will devour them. That teaches you about the public school system and academia, right? But also, pearls are wisdom. Don't put your wisdom before animals. Animals have no interest in wisdom. Precious truths are undecipherable by the unsaved. So these next few lectures are for believers. That's what they're for. By the way, all my lectures are for believers. That's what the church is for. Evangelism is an individual thing. We gather together as believers. Okay. It's best now to repeat, to recap where we have been. And some of you have already deduced the solution to the Genesis 15 birds, and you are to be commended for that. How many of you are confident that you have deduced the meaning why the two birds are not divided? How many of you? Raise your hands now. Okay, there's a few. They're not here today that are pretty confident they have this figured out. And they're not going to see the purpose of my process to come. And I ask the indulgence of them, even though there's none here today. It's my experience that what I'm going to do next is necessary. And though I skipped it previously, mostly because it's very, very difficult. And that shouldn't be the case. It really isn't the case. I have an advantage of being a locomotive electrical person, and that training prepared me for electromagnetic physics. And that's one of my assets, mathematics. Physics is an asset when you're dealing with the existence of the spirit soul. Anyway, you may have remembered a few weeks ago, Dr. Mayer came here. It was what? What day was that? It was a holiday. It must have been Christmas Eve service or something. But Dr. Lou Mayer, who I knew back at Bartlett days when he was the, when I was coaching basketball, his son Louis Mayer, who's played guitar a couple of times here, was one of my star players, maybe the best outside shooter in the history of basketball in the state of Alaska. No one knows that but me. He wants me to continue living, so that I'll continue saying that. He was that good. Anyway, a few weeks ago, his dad, Dr. Lou Mayer, who was the Bartlett Booster Club basketball chairman, we had a close relationship back then, he came and visited here. He sat where the Hinkies are sitting with his wife. And he's a man, he's a medical doctor, but he has a hobby in philosophy. And that medical knowledge and that philosophical knowledge is an understanding that is a wonderful combination when you study Scripture. The only thing probably better than that is what Jeffy has, which is law. Mathematics, medicine, law, philosophy. Anyway, he suggested that I solve the two birds the way that I'm going to do it, in an offhand remark that he made to me. And so I've been contemplating how to do it that way without overwhelming everyone. Dr. Mayer, you see, he was well aware that there's no other way, though, that the subject is that monumental. So have patience for your neighbor. As we go through this, if you've got this pretty well handled, and you think, understand that there will be others here that don't. Okay, where have we been recently? Because it all fits together. Where have we been recently? Let me recap it. Leprosy, sin, death, corruption, hopelessness, the sign of Moses, Naaman the Syrian with leprosy dipped in the river, in the Jordan River. We have disgrace, the spit in your face over the omniscience of God that was assigned to Miriam, and she was white with leprosy that connected her to Gehazi, who was also disgraceful over his denial of the omniscience of God. We had salvation by grace alone. That also connects Miriam and Gehazi. We have the death and resurrection aspects of where we've been, with leprosy, of coming out of the river, of the birds in Leviticus 14. We have witness and testifying, a crime committed. By the way, I asked, what's the crime? What are you on trial for ultimately? Not you, you're saved. What are the unsaved on trial for? They're on trial for murder, but it's also theft. They stole something that didn't belong to them and they murdered it. Soul, spirit being borrowed, lost in death and judgment and the despair. The soul and the spirit raised up, found by the throwing into the branch. The memorials, the remembrances, witness, testifying to. Okay? That's where we've been. And hopefully that spurs you to recall the past Sundays a little bit. At least a little. But you have to keep those kind of in the front. And hopefully you'll put these pieces together with what comes next. What comes next is proving your soul spirit exists. What comes next is the reconciliation of the metaphysical with the physical. All of that that we've covered, from Naaman to Miriam to the leprosy to the Leviticus 14, cleansing of the healed lepers, all of that is to reconcile the metaphysical with the physical. What is called the mind-brain problem. That's what we're doing now. Dr. Mayer came up to me and he said, You must go here. And I said, well, that's the whole point. And he wanted me to emphasize it as much as I could. And I told, normally, as I said, I kind of skip it over because of the difficulty. But he thought that it was essential. It's called ontology. First, you should read the first things I wrote here, the mind-brain problem. You might not know that there is such a thing as a mind-brain problem. You have a mind-brain problem, and you need to solve it. You need to certainly know about it. Your children need to know about it. If they don't know about it, I made this statement to a man that came to see me Thursday night. He walked in here. He had great problems with his kids. And this happens to be at the forefront of me because this is what I'm doing. And I said, have you explained to your child, your son, his mind-brain problem? No. That's why your kid's a mess. Is you have not taught him anything. You're hoping MTV does it, or video games do it, or the school system does it, or you send them to private school and you hope they do it. Do they do it? Let me ask you a quick question. How many of you have wrestled with the mind-brain problem or ontology? Good. You get into it when you start dealing with creation science. It's what it is. Ontology is the science of being, the science of reality. Also called interactionism, or radical dualism. Here's a word you have to learn, as opposed to epiphenomenalism. Or double aspect dualism, as opposed to monistic materialism or functionalism. How easy is this going to be? Let me repeat those last three, what I just did. Interactionism, or radical dualism. Radical dualism is a way of looking or trying to solve the mind-brain problem. Another way is epiphenomenalism, what's called weak dualism, a way of trying to solve the mind-brain problem. If all I get to you today is that you have a mind-brain problem that needs to be solved. We all do. There's a mind-brain problem, not just in humanity, it's also in any animated animal. We'll get into nephesh or breath later. But there's a mind-brain problem. Monistic materialism or functionalism is the third way of approaching it. Which way do you need to know? You need to know all of them. But the Bible says radical dualism. I promise you will know what these terms mean. For the sake of your children, you must know. I want you to consider the power that you have when you can prove the existence of your soul and your spirit. How powerful that is. Go to the store today, stand in the line, and just say this as you buy your Cheez-Its or your Kentucky Fried Chicken. I pick things that I, of course, want you to buy. But just imagine what you can do if you announced in the middle of Safeway today, I can prove the existence of your soul and your spirit. I can prove it. How many people would want to know that? Your children have to know it. They have to know it. Or what will be the consequence? And I promise you, you're going to know interactionism or radical dualism. You're going to know it. Epiphenomenalism and monistic materialism. Those are terms that you will use. You will discuss amongst yourselves. You will discuss with your families. Now, I presented this a few months ago with a less formidable terminology. What did I call it a few months ago? I called it immortality versus cessation of existence. I called it the immaterial versus the material. And all of that's acceptable. Choose whichever you feel comfortable with, but know what you believe. Eventually, however, you're going to have to discuss this at the very highest level. This is the mind-brain dichotomy. Let me put that word on the board. What does dichotomy mean? Yay, come to church, learn scientific nomenclature. What does dichotomy mean? No, that would be conundrum. That's correct. Two distinct things. Very well said. It's a phrase you must understand, the mind-brain dichotomy. The solution to the Genesis 15, the two undivided birds, the great truth that is the undivided birds, Genesis 15, is the mind-brain dichotomy. It's the definition, I'm sorry, it's the discussion of the metaphysical interaction with the physical. Now let me give you some more definitions. Metaphysical. Metaphysical is the branch of philosophy concerned with being and knowing. When I say metaphysical to you, it is philosophically that which can, that is concerned with being and knowing, consciousness. The metaphysical is that which is intangible. Metaphysical cognizance would be the knowledge of the intangible. The unseen, if you will, the invisible. If you want to do that, that helps you. Understanding then your existence, your being and your knowing and your consciousness is metaphysical cognizance. How much metaphysical cognizance do you have? How much time have you spent thinking about your consciousness, your knowing, your being? Understanding then your existence, your being. Thus, any discussion of the spirit soul, any attempt to prove the existence of the spirit soul is a metaphysical enterprise. It is a metaphysical reality, if you will. How's the drool fest going? Now, once the metaphysical is evaluated, then the natural progression occurs. If there is a soul spirit, then it must do something. What must it do? It interacts with some. If it's non-physical, then it must interact with the physical. The interaction between the metaphysical and the physical becomes the big question. And then let me make it a little bit more palatable. How does the mind, the soul, interface from a computer sense for you? How does it interact with the physical brain? What is the difference between the mind and the brain? That is an unsolvable question, according to science. I don't think so. The Bible solves it. Genesis 15 solves it. But it's called the mind-brain problem because they cannot figure out the difference between the mind and the brain. They know there is a difference, and they know that they both exist. One is physical, the brain. You have a physical brain. You have a metaphysical mind. How do they interact? Last week, a couple of guys came up here, Bill and Dave, and said, what happens in a brain injury? What happens to a baby when it dies? All kinds of questions come up. How does the physical and the metaphysical interact? The mind-brain problem. The evolutionist says there is no such thing as a spirit soul and everything is physical, and that's called monistic materialism or functionalism. Radical dualism says there is a mind and there is a brain and they are distinct. That is dichotomy. Dichotomy means division. So the mind-brain dichotomy is the mind-brain division. There you go. What did you just do? You just solved the birds, yeah. See how easy this is? Again, the implications of this are immense. Facing physical death without fear is one of the implications of knowing what your mind and brain do and how they interact and how they are entangled. Understanding the questions and answering the questions of resurrection. Why does God insist on resurrecting your body? As we just had a discussion this morning. The Gnostics don't believe the physical or the material has any value. They think it's evil. The Jehovah's Witnesses say you're not resurrected at all. You're annihilated if you don't believe. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you're resurrected spirit only. Christ was not resurrected physically. He did not want his physical body to be resurrected. Your physical body will not be resurrected, is what they teach. It's heresy. Biblically unsound. They do not understand radical dualism. When you understand this, you solve those questions. No Jehovah's Witness can ever confuse you again. When they come to my door, I always say the same thing. What's your position on the mind-brain dichotomy? Off they go. What does the image of God mean? You are made in the image of God. What does it mean? Can you answer that question? The study of the two birds answers that question. Hypostatic union, the virgin birth, all of those handled here. When does the mind, by the way, I think it's absolutely essential that you know this before you ever walk into a Sunday school class. If you cannot tell your kids the difference between your mind and your brain and how they interact, then stay out of the church Sunday school. You're hopeless. You're going to cause me more problems than you solve. What is the hypostatic union? That is God becoming, adding on humanity, right? How does it work? This teaches you how it works, how he did it, what's he thinking. As much as we can understand it, we're finite. It's called the mystery of the incarnation. Where does the mind come from? When does the mind first attach to the brain? When does the mind first attach to the brain? It's a big political discussion in this country. When does the mind first attach to the brain? How does the mind develop? How does the brain develop? Which one is developing? Are they developing simultaneously? Metaphysical development versus physical development. How is the metaphysical affected by the physical? When does life begin? That's pretty obvious now, isn't it, I hope? When does the mind attach to the brain? Conception. The questions that your kids will ask you, who am I? Why am I here? Solved by the two birds of Genesis 15. Why do demons seek physical bodies? miracles, what those two witnesses do. That's the metaphysical and the physical interaction. Why aren't those two birds divided in Genesis 15? And that, all of that explains today's sermon title. And I should have saved this for Ishtar. If I'd been smart, when is Ishtar, Easter? A couple of months. I couldn't make it. If I could, I could have drew it all out so that I could have the seeker-sensitive sermon for Ishtar. Unification theory for the reconciliation of physical matter and the metaphysical reality. Welcome to Cliffside. I mostly stole that title, by the way. I'm not the first to go through this. Who's the most famous for this? Descartes, René Descartes. Cartesian geometry melded with algebra. He was a math guy. So when you study geometry, you study Cartesius or Descartes. Mind-brain dichotomy. Let's go back to it. They'll call it the mind-brain division. And dichotomy, as I said, is a sophisticated term that simply means separation or division. And thus, the mind-brain dichotomy is the applied nomenclature to the mind-brain division into two parts. And now, as I said, you have solved Genesis 15. How many parts were the birds divided into? They weren't divided. Oops. We can stop now because we've solved Genesis 15. Not really. We really can't stop. But it's obvious as you study Genesis that the mind-brain dichotomy is illogical. There is no mind-brain dichotomy. There is no mind-brain separation. There is no mind-brain division. It is inconsistent with reality. It is not biblical. The mind-brain is inseparable. This caveat, hang on. The mind-brain is inseparable. Mind-brain dichotomy is a contradiction in terms. There is no division of the mind and the brain until physical death. What is the purpose of resurrection? To put it back together. The mind and the brain back together. Now this is a readily apparent truth that the mind and brain are not divided into two parts. It can be proven, has been proven. It's not that difficult. It's obviously biblically. It's obviously scientifically provable. Genesis 15, 6 through 8, you can know that you will have eternal life. God will prove to you it can be known. Assurance of salvation, the assurance of the existence of your soul and your spirit can be proved. You should be able to prove it. I can prove it. I'm not that much smarter than you. I'm not, most of you. Takes time, takes energy, takes effort. You have to care. I would think that all Christians would want to know this. But I'm wrong about that. Most Christians could care less. Most Christians would prefer to feel. It's a very small minority that asked the question of Abraham. Genesis 15:8, the great question of Abraham, Genesis 15:8, how shall I know? Abraham got to a place where he was going to put a knife through his son Isaac because he knew the difference and the interfacing and the interaction of the mind and the brain. He knew the existence of his soul spirit. He had absolute confidence that Isaac was not going to die. He had no fear. How did he get there? Because I know we're typical. I know our fear of death is real. And I've often wondered about why that is, why so few Christians care about Genesis 15, why so few care about the wisdom and the understanding that the Bible gives. Eventually it became obvious to me, the more you know something, the more what? To whom much is given what? That's right. The more you know, the harder your job. See, atheistic Darwinism, which is monistic, functionalism, atheistic Darwinism / evolution is constantly defended by those who openly object to accountability for our life that has been given to us. Where did their mind come from? Where does your mind come from? You should answer immediately that God gives your mind to you. He puts it and the physical brain together and it develops. Now, question is, where did their mind come from? From the same place. All minds come from the same place. And atheism objects to the accountability for that given mind, for that given life. Aldous Huxley, of the famous Huxley family, Thomas and Julian Huxley, defenders of evolution, he was candid about it. Atheistic evolution, he said, was a liberation to him. Said it constantly, all the time. He wanted to believe in meaninglessness, to believe there is no purpose, and to believe that was to be freed from something. Freed from what? Morality. Said so. Specifically said sexual morality. He wanted to be freed from that. He wanted to be liberated. That's why he believed in evolution. Evolution fundamentally is a system that excuses sin. That's what its intention is. It's always been that way. It's been anciently that way. Okay, now we're on to the easy part of solving the mind-brain problem of proving the existence of the soul spirit. There's a few things that are required. Okay, first, you have to have a basic introduction to quantum mechanics. I'll say physics. You have to have a basic understanding, introduction of quantum physics. How many of you took quantum physics in college or high school? One? Was that you? Good. One is what I expected. Two, you have to have a basic introduction to what's called classical Newtonian physics. What did we learn in church today? You need to know the difference between quantum physics and classical Newtonian physics. You have to have a working knowledge of what's called locality and non-locality. You must know, here's where locomotive electricity is so handy, you must understand electromagnetic energy. What am I proving to you? Huh? No, I'm not. That's not true. I am proving to you that your soul exists. Keep that in mind. You must understand the physical characteristics of entanglement. Zero point energy. Quantum teleportation. Subatomic construction. That'd be atomic diameter and atomic mass. This is the most important, frankly, irreducible complexity. The metaphysical implications of empty space. I'm just going to put empty space down. But you need to know that it is the I better put it down. Metaphysical. Metaphysical implications of empty space. If you understand what empty space means, then you will begin to understand the existence of your soul. Superstring theory. You've probably heard of string theory, but you need to know superstring theory. We will bypass string theory and go right to superstring. Oh, I guess I'll put it over here. L, observer effect. Quarks. Gluon field. And then length, width, height, and time. Now, how easy is that? That's not bad, really. I promise you in 3 weeks, you will understand every one of those terms if you come every week. Now I'll give you the easy part. Demonstration. Okay. One of the other advantages of the physics of rotating spheres, pool, is that you learn subatomic theory. Atoms, subatomic construction, quantum physics. Atoms are unimaginably small. Okay? So you have to answer the question, what am I made of? How am I put together? How am I designed? What is my construction? Atoms are unimaginably small. You're made of atoms. They're 1,000,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. So pluck a hair out and look at its diameter, how big it is, how thick it is. One atom is 1,000,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. An atom is 1 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters. Now that's algebra, and I understand scientific notation, but understand that atoms are very, very small. That's all you need to know. 1,000,000 atoms, if I put them edge to edge, they would equate to the width of a human hair or the depth of a piece of sheet paper. If I had 1,000,000 atoms, I stacked them up, they would be the thickness of a piece of paper. Okay, a dot. Everybody see that? Good. A dot contains 100 billion atoms. And atoms consist of what? Back to high school you are. Actually, eighth grade. What do the atoms consist of? Electrons and neutrons and protons. Okay? Subatomic construction, I said, was atomic mass and atomic diameter. I have a nucleus and I have protons and neutrons in it, and I have electrons circling it. That is the subatomic construction. The diameter of that atom is its atomic diameter. How big it is. So I measure from the outer electron, okay, to the nucleus, and I get its entire width, if you want to put it that way. And the nucleus, so let me draw it this way. If I'm going to draw an atom, you've seen them all drawn, right?
There's my electrons, right? I'll make another one. It makes you feel better, you know, recognize it. The atomic diameter is that distance. Does that make sense? Welcome to quantum mechanics, quantum physics. Okay, the nucleus is very, that, now that's, so when I say an atom, I need a million of them in order to stack them up. That's how wide they are. Now the nucleus is obviously much smaller than the atomic diameter, correct? Okay? The nucleus is very tiny. It's 23,000 to 150 times 1,000, depending on what type of atom it is, whether or not it's a hydrogen or it's a lead or whatever atom it is. It's 23,000 to 150,000 times smaller than the atomic diameter. So we'll say it's 100,000 times smaller than the diameter of our typical atom. And it's comprised of positively charged protons, And neutrons. So I have positives and I have neutrals. And the electron is negative. Right off the bat, you're in conflict with classical Newtonian physics. And you know this because you have played with magnets. I have a negative particle, and I have lots of positive particles in here, by the way. I have a negative particle going around positive and neutral. If I take two magnets and I have a north pole and a north pole and I try to put them together, what do? They repel each other, right? Classical Newtonian physics. Why don't those positive protons repel each other? Why doesn't that electron, negative electron, collapse upon those positives? Why is this diameter maintained? Classical Newtonian physics is in conflict with quantum mechanics. I would expect that, by the way, because I've read the Bible. Orbiting electrons, if the nucleus is 100 times smaller than the atom, orbiting electrons are 2,000 times smaller than the proton. We're talking, you are made of very tiny things. Very tiny. That should not hold themselves together. It should fly apart or collapse. Should do both. Fly apart and collapse. To see one atom. Okay, remember, everybody see my dot? There's billions of them in my dot. To see one atom with the naked eye, we would have to magnify that dot that I drew there. We'd have to magnify that dot to a diameter of 100 meters. So I expand that dot to 100 meters. That's the width of a football field. Okay? So that dot is now, think of the dot, is 100 meters long. To see the nucleus of one atom, in other words, to find one atom in the dot, I got to make that dot the size of a football field. To see the nucleus of one atom, I'd have to magnify the dot to 10,000 kilometers. That's the distance between the North and the South Pole. In order to see the nucleus. If the nucleus were the size of my cue ball, how far away is the electron? Almost 3 miles away. Okay? So, and how big is it? It's the size of that dot. If this is my nucleus, orbiting my nucleus is a dot. That is 3 miles away. That's what you're made of. Now the obvious question is what is between the nucleus and the dot, the electron? And the answer is the metaphysical implications of empty space. Now this will be difficult for you to understand, but quantum physicists say that the atoms are not particle-based mass. which means that's the opposite of Newtonian physics that says everything is a particle-based mass. Quantum mechanics says there's no mass. There's no particles. Quantum physicists say that this is just interaction between energy and a gluon field. Where's gluon field? Quantum physicists say that electrons are non-particles. They're not even a dot. What they are clouds. They're kind of a vapor thing that has a negative electromagnetic energy. In other words, the dot that's circling 3 miles away isn't really a dot. It has no mass. It's not a particle. It's what? Negative base energy. It is structureless. And it is opposed to the classic laws of electromagnetism. Newtonian physics fail at the subatomic level. What keeps this all together? What holds it all together? Let me read it to you. Colossians 1:17. Because that's a bad question. What holds it all together? Because it isn't what. It's who. Here it is. And He is before all things, and in Him all things are held together. It says consist, but the word means to place together, to hold together. God is opposing Isaac Newton classical physics. Doesn't surprise me. He loved it. Isaac Newton as a saved man. And Newtonian physics actually work on things, but they don't work at the subatomic level at all. I would expect that from God. He has a great sense of humor. I'm learning as I meet more Christians. So what am I? What are you? You and I are empty space. That's what we are. We are empty space. I love the people that say, if I can touch it, feel it, see it, then I'll believe it. You can't touch, feel, or see yourself. We are empty space. Descartes said this, I think, therefore I exist. You might have heard it say, I think, therefore I am. He didn't. He said, I think, therefore I exist. And he's absolutely right about that. Your metaphysical spirit soul was put in place in you by God. It is the iron axe head that floats to the surface. It will return to Him either in joy and salvation and be reconciled with this physical body that is what? Empty space. Or it will be condemned into torment everlasting. That is the beginning of proving to you that your soul spirit exists. How far did we get? Not very far. That is why the two birds are not divided. How far did we get there? Not very far. Next week, you will understand entanglement, locality, and non-locality, irreducible complexity, and teleportation. Hopefully, by the end of the week after that, we'll get into superstring theory. And then you will understand how your spirit and your brain respond. What happens when your brain dies? Physically, and your body dies physically. What happens to your mind? Let's rise. Be dismissed.